Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And on our show today, we're going to be talking with Professor and Senior Associate Dean for Geriatrics at the Charles E. Schmidt College of Medicine, Dr. Joseph Auslander, about reducing unnecessary hospitalizations among nursing home patients. A really important topic, Christy, that we just read about in the New England Journal of Medicine.
Absolutely. An important topic, something that's near and dear to us as we think about our family members and our patients in nursing homes and trying to really respect the patients themselves and look out for what's best for them, which isn't always the hospital. So we'll talk about that.
Yeah. And first, Christy, well, first off, you know, this is the first time we've been back together co-hosting the show in a number of weeks.
Happy
here.
2012.
I was on some vacation. You've been helping the residency review committee get recertified for our program. So thank you for what you've done.
Sure. Been working hard in different ways, but I'm glad to be back.
Well, we've got some great research that matters this week about bone density studies and new guidelines that could evolve.
We'll talk about eating plant compounds in relationship to heart deaths.
And pomegranate seeds, yes, and hot flashes.
And vitamin D and lung disease.
Well, let's first jump right in there about a study that was in the New England Journal of Medicine about bone density screening for every woman and a lot of men out there. This is a critically important issue about how often should you get screened or not.
It is so important, and we would be talking about this regardless, but I have to just put the plug in that we are so proud of our colleague, Dr. Margaret Gourlay, in our Department of Family Medicine, who's the lead author in this new England Journal of Medicine study.
Right. So normally there are guidelines out there that look at how often women should get bone density screening, and depending on which group one might look at, women under age 65, unless they have some significant risk factors, may not get screened. But women age 65 and older and or men who have risk factors could get screening. And the research that comes up, though, is that's kind of a generic guideline that could apply to large groups. Is there any way to narrow this down and have better decision that's based not on statistics, but based on maybe actual patient populations?
Actual patients. So this was a study of about 4,000 women who were studied for 15 years and looking to see those who were screened, what happened to their bones over time, to try to help us get a better understanding of how often we should screen and which populations to focus on.
And they calculate from the bone density screening what's called the T-score. And I guess this is one of those numbers you probably need to know. And depending on your T-score, which is a risk of developing osteoporosis or osteopenia, the thinning of the bones, the less severe form, what you need to do and how often you need to do it.
And they found that if you had the normal T-score, and so women 67 years of age or older, if you started out with a normal T-score of negative 1.00 or higher, it took an average of almost 17 years for only 10% of that group to develop osteoporosis.
So you might be up to age 82 and have a very low risk, so you might not need to have that bone density screening done again for at least 15 years.
Right. But for people who had the really low scores of that T-score from the bone density screening of negative 2 to almost negative 2.5, that interval was just 1 year.
And if you were in the middle with that T-score, negative 1.5 to negative 0.2, about 4.5 to 5 years. So this begins to give us some idea of maybe which group of women need to have more aggressive screening and follow-up, and which group of women and men might not need to be followed up nearly as aggressively.
And I think, regardless, you should have this conversation with your doctor. Like, this is practice changing. So if you've already had a bone density test, this would be a good thing for you to bring up with your doctor to say, well, what does this mean for me? Let's go over my T-score. And if you are over the age of 65 and have never had a bone density test, it'd be a good time to get one.
Well, let's move on and let's look at some next research that matters that looks at plant compounds that have high in certain chemicals that or the plant foods and its relationship to heart disease.
So this was a study on nearly 100,000 older U.S. adults, finding that the people who got the most flavonoids in their diets.
Things
how do you
like,
say it?
I say flavonoids and. But I also can say things like berries and citrus and apples.
Broccoli, spinach, nuts, yep. Soy, dark chocolate.
Yep.
These kinds of plant-based foods. People who eat the most of them were less likely to die of heart disease or stroke over the next 7 years than the people who ate the least amount of these plant foods.
And just to give a difference here, those with the highest flavonoid intake had about 20 servings of fruits and 24 servings of vegetables a week. And those in the lowest group had about 11 servings of fruit, almost half as few, and 18 servings of vegetables per week. And there was a significant difference, about a 20% reduction in heart disease if you were in that higher group.
Do you eat a lot of plant foods, Adam?
I'm vegetarian, Christy.
You do.
I eat a lot of plant foods, maybe not much fruit as I should, but I think I get a lot of flavonoids. I like this study.
Good. Well, it looks like that's going to protect you over time, so I'm happy to hear it.
Well, this was in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, and we'll put a nice link up about ways to increase flavonoids in your diet.
Great. Well, the next study is about another diet-based thing about pomegranate seed oil and whether or not it can help calm down hot flashes.
And to be honest with you, Christy, I knew nothing about pomegranate seed oil. I didn't know that it was high in natural phytoestrogens, the types of things that mimic estrogens, and which we know that estrogens reduce hot flashes, but also has side effects.
Right. And so there are all these different herbal things that have been out or natural things that are related to these phytoestrogens that have been marketed as sort of an alternative treatment for menopausal symptoms. And this is really the first clinical study of pomegranate seed oil as a treatment to see if it makes a difference.
And they had 81 women who had lots of hot flashes, and some of them got this pomegranate seed oil and some of them got a placebo that didn't have any extract of that pomegranate seed, and they actually both had significant reductions in their hot flashes.
I think the good news is they both got better, probably from what's called the placebo effect, where you're taking something and you feel like it's getting better. But in this study, there wasn't a significant difference between the people who took the pomegranate seed oil and the people who took placebo.
Right. It was a 13% difference, but they had small numbers in the study. So one of my concerns is actually that there could be a small difference, but maybe they didn't have enough people to actually show that.
Yeah. At this point, I think if it helps you and you've been taking it and you feel like it's helpful, then I wouldn't necessarily recommend stopping it based on this, but I wouldn't, as a physician, recommend this to my patients.
Right. And tell your doctor if you are. And our very last research that matters, short answer here, real hope with people with lung disease, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, if they took a vitamin D supplement, that this would lead to less chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. Did it happen, Christy?
Unfortunately, it did not. So vitamin D has just been studied and studied with all these beautiful benefits. And that thought was that since it might help reduce inflammation, it might help people who have this chronic lung disease have fewer times that it flares up. And in this case, they found no difference between
182
groups.
People who got it and didn't. And they pretty much had the same hospitalizations and exacerbations of their disease. So if you have vitamin D deficiency, it's okay to be taking vitamin D, but we wouldn't advise taking it just to reduce the risk from if you have the COPD.
Absolutely. Okay, so we've talked a little bit about vitamin D and about pomegranate seed oil.
About these plant compounds, the flavonoids, and finally about screening of bone density. But that'll conclude then, Christy, our research that matters. We'll take a short break. When we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Joseph Auslander about reducing unnecessary hospitalizations. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, we'll be talking with Professor and Senior Associate Dean for Geriatric Programs at the Charles E. Schmidt College of Medicine, Dr. Joseph Auslander, about reducing unnecessary hospitalizations of nursing home residents. Dr. Auslander is an internationally recognized geriatrician and also serves as an executive editor for the Journal of the American Geriatric Society. We're so glad to have this conversation.
Dr. Auslander, welcome to Your Health. And let's just dive right in, which tell us how you have become so interested and have developed this expertise in what affects probably most, if not all of us, as we get older.
Well, thanks for having me on the show. I've been taking care of people in long-term care institutions and older people in the community for about 30 years. A lot of my time has been spent working in the nursing home environment, taking care of people, developing teaching and research programs, and being an administrator. And when you work in that environment, it's very clear that there are many ways that you can improve care. And one of them is to improve the management of nursing home residents when they become acutely ill, in ways that help prevent hospitalizations when it's feasible and safe.
Give us a picture. We're talking about keeping people who are in nursing homes out of the hospital when they're not, maybe those hospitalizations aren't needed. Give us a story or an example of the type of patient or the scenario we're talking about of a patient who has an unnecessary hospitalization.
Well, there are different types of scenarios. So a common one would be a nursing home resident who develops a cough and a very low-grade fever. And this often occurs during off hours in the evening on a weekend. And the nurses call a physician who's covering, who may not know the nursing home well or may not know the nursing home resident well. And the communication is not as good as it could be. And the easiest thing for the physician to do is to send the person to the emergency room. And once a frail elderly nursing home resident gets to an emergency room, they most often get admitted to the hospital. In another scenario, though, that same nursing home resident could undergo a better evaluation by a nurse using some evidence-based protocols and give better information to the physician, and they make a joint decision in conjunction with the resident and their family to try and manage the condition in the nursing home.
Well, you know, you've just given a great scenario of a potentially avoidable hospitalization. But isn't one of the difficulties here that hindsight is always perfect? You know, how do you know as you're looking forward what is potentially avoidable or not? Help us understand, first off, the language. When we talk about avoidable hospitalization, what are we really talking about?
Well, that's a good question. There are many ways to define that, but the way that it's been defined the type of research that's been done is could this person have been managed safely at a lower level of care? And and that's a clinical judgment, but there are specific signs and symptoms you would look for that could certainly indicate the need to be transferred to an emergency room or a hospital.
Like what?
Well, for example, a very low blood pressure or an acute change in mental status where someone is not alert, they're not able to eat, or a very high heart rate or a very high fever. But in older people, these things are obvious, but a lot of times symptoms and signs are rather subtle. And they may not meet those type of criteria to urgently transfer someone to the hospital. So there's a lot of judgment involved.
One of the things you mentioned in your story was the physician perhaps not knowing the patient because of covering a number of nursing homes on a given evening. What do we know about decision-making of physicians who are that primary patient's primary care provider or who actually do know the clinical picture of what this person is normally like?
Yeah, that's a good question. So there is research that shows that when primary care physicians are involved, or primary care physicians in collaboration with nurse practitioners who see people more regularly, that is associated with fewer hospital transfers and fewer hospitalizations. And there are many ways that can happen, but it's certainly better to have coverage by a physician or a nurse practitioner who understands the nursing home environment and understands how to evaluate and assess symptoms that may or may not require transfer to the hospital.
We're speaking with Dr. Joseph Auslander about reducing unnecessary hospitalizations of nursing home residents. And Dr. Auslander, it seems that the trend, certainly in our experience over the last decade, has been reduced numbers of physicians that both care for patients in the clinic and care for them in the hospital with the advent of hospitalists. And so it would seem that increasingly the person who's covering those phone calls may not be aware. Are there efforts underway to try to, how do we deal with that kind of trend with the realization that care could be better if you do know the patient?
Yeah, I think there are ways to deal with that. We've designed a quality improvement program for nursing homes called INTERACT, Interventions to Reduce Acute Care Transfers, that include a lot of clinical practice tools that will assist and bolster the skills and knowledge of nurses who work in nursing homes. Another strategy is to increase the involvement of nurse practitioners or physician assistants in that setting because of what we just talked about. The other interesting potential is I've been involved in developing a project where it's possible to cover people after hours using telemedicine, where there isn't good access to coverage by physicians or nurse practitioners who know the environment or know the nursing home residents. So I think that's an interesting possibility that should be explored.
I like the way you're talking about the team approach with, you know, nurses that are well-trained in clinical protocols, nurse practitioners, physicians, and technology. It's wonderful. But I wonder what efforts have been made or what do we know about the involvements of families in these decisions?
Great question. And this is the hospitalization, the decision to transfer someone to a hospital is really a person-centered decision. And we often hear in some of the research that we've been doing is that families insist on the transfer, and that's often true. And we've got to understand that we have to respect families' wishes and residents' wishes, but they often don't understand the risks and benefits. So I think that what has to happen, and we're going to be adding this actually to our INTERACT program, is education of family members and nursing home residents about the benefits as well as the potential risks.
Like what? Yeah, the benefits seem easy. Right before the break, can you give us an example of like maybe two risks that people wouldn't normally think about?
Well, sure. Just the emotional and physical trauma and the anxiety of being transferred into a hospital, and then there's a very high risk of many hospital-acquired complications, including falls and infections and adverse drug reactions. So there are many significant risks that have to be weighed against the benefits of hospitalization.
Well, that's a great little bookmark for us to take as we take a break. We do need to take this break. When we come back, we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. Joseph Auslander, about reducing unnecessary hospitalizations of nursing home residents. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Professor and Senior Associate Dean for Geriatric Programs at the Charles E. Schmidt College of Medicine, Dr. Joseph Auslander, about hospitalizations of nursing home residents, what's necessary and what may not be necessary. And Dr. Auslander, you've given some really great examples, I think, of some of the risk involved and some of the ways that in the training and care and quality improvement, we might be able to avoid these. And I wonder, is there a risk among certain populations of patients, maybe our Medicaid population or those who maybe have less resources, that we're somehow denying them access to something that they deserve? Or is there some risk that maybe we're really not, that this is not being perceived as good care?
Well, I think that's a really good point. It's a complicated one. I'll emphasize that the decision about how to manage an acute changing condition, whether you manage it in the nursing home or in the decide to transfer someone to the hospital, is a very person-centered decision that involves a lot of different factors. And I think that whether this is occurring in someone who is on Medicaid or of a different ethnic origin, I really don't think that should matter in the clinical decision making. I think it's a shared decision looking at the clinical status of the individual person. Can they possibly avoid a transfer to the hospital safely? And is that something that they perceive in their best interest? These decisions can be very tough, but the most important thing is for the nursing home resident and their family to have a trusting relationship with the people who are providing care for them. The nurses in the nursing home, the physicians, all the staff in the nursing home, they have to trust them, and they have to get good communication from them. And then if that happens, the right decisions will be made.
Well, and it takes some time to develop that trust. Even just explaining, even at the hospital on admission, counseling patients about the risks of hospitalization with what you were talking about, falls and delirium and or getting confused or catching an infection in the hospital. Those things are hard. I mean, people sometimes perceive them as if you're trying to save money. But if you have those long-term relationships with people, you've already, you know, reached that point where they can trust that you're thinking about their best interest. And I wonder what sort of, I guess those are things that the people and physicians and nurses in those long-term care facilities are having to work at from the very beginning. Are those discussions that people are having before the acute moment?
Yes, that's a good point. One of the three strategies that we use in our INTERACT Quality Improvement Program is to improve the use of advanced care planning. Advanced care planning is just those kind of frank discussion, very person-centered discussions between the people that are taking care of someone, the nursing home resident, and their family.
Can you give us an example of one maybe that you were involved with recently?
Well, I can give you an example. Sometimes care, from my standpoint as a geriatrician, care interventions, including sending someone to the hospital, is medically futile care, and I think it's very important not to frame this in terms of cost. It's what's in the best interest of the individual. And when someone has, for example, end-stage congestive heart failure, where you know that their future holds multiple exacerbations of that heart failure that may require hospitalizations that are uncomfortable and put them at risk. Sometimes you just have to talk to people about what the future holds, what's futile care, and what the goal of care is. And in my experience with that type of patient and their family, if they trust you and they agree that the goal of care is comfort at this point, not prolongation of life, but comfort and dignity, I think the right decisions will be made.
Well, you know, we're speaking with Dr. Joseph Auslander about unnecessary hospitalization. Dr. Auslander, you just had a very thoughtful one of the lead articles in the New England Journal of Medicine about this issue. And you raised something in that article, which I found, even as a provider, I don't think I really knew, which is the financial incentive is not necessarily just to keep someone out of a hospital. In some cases, there's a financial incentive to have the patient go in the hospital. Can you just mention that briefly and what we can do to protect against that type of unnecessary hospitalization on that end?
Well, hospitalizations are very costly, and unfortunately, in our Medicare fee-for-service system, and for the listeners, 70 to 80% of people who are on Medicare are on fee-for-service payment, and 20 to 30% of people on Medicare nationwide are in some type of managed care program. For example, in southern Florida, the biggest one is Humana. There are many others. And in the Medicare fee-for-service program, the financial incentive is to do something because providers are being paid for it. And that's what the situation is for hospitalization and hospital transfer. So there are many different ways that the Medicare fee-for-service system financially incentivizes healthcare providers to do the wrong thing in some circumstances. How do we change that? Well, I think that there are a lot of efforts underway under healthcare reform to look at different ways to think about payment policy. One, for example, would be paying providers to coordinate care better and incentivizing them to reduce inappropriate, unnecessary expenditures and at the same time improve quality of care. And we can do that. So I think there's a great opportunity to meet what the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services calls the triple aim, which is improving care, improving health, and reducing costs. We have a great opportunity to do that.
In thinking about from a patient's perspective, so now we've had this conversation and I'm looking in the future. At one point, I will be helping my parents navigate through their elderly lives. And what recommendations do you have for me as a patient or for family members who are listening in how to have these conversations with a nursing home or how to find out quality or perspectives about a given long-term care facility in relationship to unnecessary hospitalizations?
Well, I think that there's at least two parts to your answer. In terms of how do you prepare to have these type of conversations, I think that everyone should consider having an advance directive meaning either a living will or a durable power of attorney for healthcare where you thought about the decisions you'd want made if you became very ill.
Mm-hmm.
And just as importantly, who makes those decisions for you? And that's a discussion you have with your family and other loved ones, as well as your healthcare providers. So that's a very important aspect of advanced care planning. The other thing I think that's important is to understand that in the specific situation we're talking about, there are risks as well as benefits of every type of medical intervention, and people ought to work with the health professionals that they trust to better understand those risks and benefits.
Yeah, I know one thing you mentioned in your article in addition is looking for, or that a nursing home will need to have the right staffing, and will have to have the right infrastructure and the right leadership to also commit to these things, because we could do it all as providers, but if the nursing home itself isn't committed to this, and so I imagine that ultimately that has to be part of the reform.
Yes, and I think I wanted to address Christy's question also by saying that there are ways to look at the quality of nursing homes. So for listeners that don't know, you can go to the Medicare.gov website, and there's a section there called Nursing Home Compare. And you can actually compare nursing homes on key measures of quality. There's also a 5-star quality rating system. Nursing homes are rated on quality based on 1 to 5 stars. And that the way that that's done is actually being revised right now. I'm on the panel that's helping think that through.
So we know who to call then.
No. I think that it's good that the federal government is involving people who are knowledgeable in this area to try and make measures that make sense for patients and their families.
Absolutely.
I think the other point you raise is that nursing homes have to have the infrastructure to provide safe care in the nursing home. And what I'm arguing on a healthcare policy basis is that if nursing homes do a better job, they improve care, and unnecessary costs are reduced, some of those savings ought to be shared with providers so that they can further improve care and provide the infrastructure that's necessary to do good care. And that's a key concept, is this idea that we can improve care, we can reduce costs, and some of those savings can be shared to further improve the quality of our health care.
We are sure glad that you are leading the way on this, and we appreciate you taking time to talk with us about it. We've been talking with Dr. Joseph Auslander about reducing unnecessary hospitalizations of nursing home residents. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for having me.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Christy, we're going to answer our listeners' health questions and concerns.
And we've got some good ones today, but those of you out there, if you have a question you want us to address, please send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu, and Adam and I will answer those on a future show. But right now, Adam, we've got some real good ones, don't we?
Yep. Let's listen to our very first one about a patient with esophageal spasms.
I was told that I have esophageal spasm by my doctor. I've had reflux for a long time, but more recently, I had more sustained pain in my chest. I am only 34 years old, and I wonder if it was my heart or not. How do you diagnose spasm, and what can you do about it?
Well, you know, I think that's a question about esophageal spasm that a lot of listeners, and I imagine if a doctor had the same symptoms, may also wonder, is this my heart or is this my esophagus, or, you know, what's causing this problem with this pain in my chest?
Yeah, and unfortunately, more than half of the patients who go to emergency departments with chest pain or unexplained chest pain and will have their heart ruled out. It's not your heart. But the question, and then many are sent home, well, we know it's not your heart, well, we're not quite sure what it is. And this might be that falls into that category.
And certainly you have to make sure that it isn't your heart. And a lot of times people do get admitted to the hospital with this. But once you know that it's not your heart, this idea that it could be a spasm in your esophagus certainly is a possibility. And for some people, maybe should be looked into.
Sure. Well, and one of the things about spasm in your esophagus is that some of the medicine that helps calm pain that does come from your heart also can help an esophageal spasm get
better.
Like
those things like nitroglycerin, which is a nitrate. That's one of those medicines that can work in both areas. And then there's some medicines that are more specific to spasm, things called calcium channel blockers that can relieve and kind of help that spasm go away.
The other thing is if you've had acid reflux for a really long time, most folks after 5 years or so of you continuing to have symptoms and needing treatment, you might consider if you need endoscopy or the test where they look down into your esophagus
sometimes
to see what's
EGD.
Happening.
EGD.
Yes.
We won't try to spell that word.
No, it's a big one.
Well, hopefully that's a helpful to your really good question, and thank you so much. And let's take a listen to our very next house call.
What do you do if you feel that you need psychiatric help and yet you have no insurance?
That's a really important question and a tough one that I wish I could see you face to face and have a conversation to know a little bit more about what's going on. But thankfully, we do have resources in our state. Each county does have resources for folks, even if you don't have insurance and even if you're not able to pay.
And we, Christy and I, wouldn't necessarily know if every state has the same sorts of resources, but the Department of Health and Human Services, which administers really mental health benefits around the state, has specialty areas for mental health, and every county by law has to have local management entities where you can receive mental health benefits. And so for the University of North Carolina in Orange County, there's a three county area, Pearson County, Alamance County. What are the three counties, Christy?
There's Orange, Pearson, Alamance.
Mental health benefits where you can, if you have no insurance, you can go get information. And there's 1-800 numbers, for instance, in North Carolina, 1-800-784-2433 is a crisis number where you can call and get information if you really need that information. And we'll put it on our website.
The other resources that can be helpful is if you go to your doctor. If you have a doctor at a community health center or at UNC or wherever you go, that person can help navigate this for you and can help you get in with the right person. Who can help you. And you can also call the hospital, just 96641, that's 919-966-4131, and ask to talk to a psychiatrist on call to help you sort out if you feel like you're having a more urgent need that doesn't
want to wait. And hospitals' emergency rooms have the walk-in crisis services for which they can't turn you away. There's these 24-hour crisis lines. And even at the University of North Carolina, there's a walk-in outpatient that you can walk in and during the daytime, not necessarily in the emergency room. So lots of resources, and though it's a difficult issue because no insurance makes it harder to see private practitioners. Actually, yes, Christy, it's Orange, Pearson, and Chatham in our region here. So hopefully you can get some help, and thanks for what is an important question.
Oh, and I would say please take home the message that you should find those resources. Do talk to someone.
Yeah, actually, nationally, Christy, nationally, the number is 1-800-SUICIDE if you're having those type of concerns, or if you just need someone to talk to, it's 1-800-273-TALK. And we'll put those numbers up.
Okay, let's take our very next house call question.
I'm 73 years old, and I had a mastectomy 12 years ago for a small breast cancer seen on a mammogram. Every year since, it has been normal. When can I stop getting mammograms?
Well, we assume, and we're glad that actually you're doing well 12 years out.
Yes, congratulations.
You know, this is lots of breast cancer survivors, and we assume that you had the mastectomy on one side, and your question has to do with, do you continue to have to get screening? Because it could have been a partial mastectomy. It may not have been a whole one. It could have been what's called a lumpectomy, where a certain portion taken out. But what about the other breast? How long do you have to have mammograms?
You know, the truth is, this is a mistake that a lot of people make to sort of let their guard down after a period of time. You're right in that you're at higher risk of getting a breast cancer recurrence in the first year and then in the first 5 years, but then your risk stays higher, particularly in that other, the breast that's still remaining over the next, I think, 25 plus years. And so the recommendations would be that you continue really close surveillance.
Yeah, I think we would not want to see you reduce your annual mammograms, but to continue doing them and to encourage other women who may be in similar situations. Thank you so much for your question. Let's listen, Christy, to our very last house call.
Hey, Dr. Page, Dr. Goldstein. Recently, I went to my pharmacist to get a prescription from my dermatologist filled. It was a cream for my arms to cure pre-skin cancers. My dermatologist said to use sunblock, but the pharmacist said that I should not use sunblock because it might interfere with the medicine working. I wonder what you think. And in addition, will the medicine hurt my normal skin?
This is a common scenario that Christy and I hear more and more, which is people get advice from lots of different sources, and physicians aren't the only source that our patients get advice from.
Well, and thankfully, because, you know, we want to work as a team and you can get information from different sources, and that's super important. In this case, it sounds like the medicine you're using is one that you can get a really, really bad sunburn from if you're using it and go out in the sun. So the common advice here is be careful about the sun when you're taking this medication.
And I think the real question would be to ask your dermatologist, let them know what the pharmacist said, mm-hmm. and ask them why the pharmacist might have said that, and ask your pharmacist what the dermatologist said, and hopefully bring you together, because chances are you might be talking about slightly different elements here, and they could both be true. So understand more, ask more questions. We like your question, and we like actually all of our questions today for house calls. So thank you for joining us today for your health. We hope we've addressed issues that are important to you, and you can send any of your own house calls to us at yourhealth@unc.edu.
You can also visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes. You can get free podcasts of each show for download on the iTunes Store.
We'd like to thank WCHL and the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Joseph Auslander. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
We will look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360, WCHL.